So the maker movement is an awesome experience in sort of community-based making, right? So we see in the informal spaces that people are passionate about their projects. They're leveraging expertise within a specific discipline. They're collaborating and communicating with others that are found within these community spaces around making. Education looks at that and says, oh my God, these are all things that we want.
It is my love, my life. I love it, I love it. So making to me is, I feel really strongly, and it's a line I use a lot, I don't believe in snobbiness when it comes to making.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. This week we're in Takeover with LEGO Education to explore what maketh a maker. Earlier this year, LEGO Education launched its new maker activities for school educators at legoeducation.com/maker. If you check out the URL, you'll see ideas on how to start a makerspace, as well as maker project ideas incorporating LEGO. The Maker Launch also encourages teachers to enter the annual LEGO Education Teacher Awards to showcase their maker projects. So if you know someone doing amazing work in the area, tell them to enter. But what is making, makerspaces, or maker? In this episode of the EdTech Podcast, we're in Takeover exploring the maker movement with educators from preschool to university. You'll hear recordings from the Atmospheric Institute of Imagination in Lambeth, London, during LEGO's Maker Launch Evening during BET Week 2018. We delve into what maker means, how it can go wrong and go right, and what happens when you try and light up a multi-story building in a maker experiment on live television. Listen in to hear from Kate McCulhey, Imperial College Reach Out Makerspace Coordinator, Karen Walsh, Geek Mum and Hertford University Lecturer, Ethan Danahy, Research Assistant Professor in EdTech at Tufts University, Kate Kramer, Manager of the Happy Hours Preschool near Reading, and Mia Chapman, Head of Education at Maker Club. Have a great week! Yay! So I'm here with Kate
Mulcahy. It's close enough.
I don't know
close
why
enough.
I have to say it like that. Great, I'm very delighted that you came along, and
thank you for inviting me.
Kate, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what you do and why you're here?
Okay, so I basically manage Imperial College's new makerspace. It's built in White City. It is run out of the outreach team, and the main goal of that is to create a space that has design, engineering, making, crafting, everything tools that local students from the White City area can get access to, and later everyone in London or the whole of the UK, who knows, can have access to amazing makerspace.
And what kind of size are we talking about here?
I do make it sound like the size of the Olympic Park. It exists within a building called the Invention Rooms. I'll talk to your numbers. So the makerspace is designed so that at least 20 to 30 students can comfortably move around and use all the equipment freely. So it's quite large, we've open seating, it's nice and breezy. And then attached to it, there's a design studio. So we have two spaces, one with technical equipment and then another for prototyping, ideation, but also softer skills, like the sewing machines can be moved in there if necessary and stuff.
That's very cool.
Yeah. The Invention Rooms is a whole building that has essentially three key components. There's the makerspace, which is the bit I run, that's in the middle. I like to think of it as the heart of the Invention Room.
Beating heart.
And then connected to that, we have the hack space, which is a makerspace for Imperial staff and students. The running joke between the two of us is they have the same equipment as us, except bigger. So we have a vacuum former. They were building a vacuum former, and their goal was that their vacuum former could hold our vacuum form. They're going to vacuum form our vacuum
form. It's a bit like with the skyscrapers, you know, you have to build it's it like
we could do one bigger. Exactly,
taller,
exactly.
Yeah.
So they've got slightly more advanced stuff for staff and students. But what's great is we share and pool resources. So we, if we need to, can use their more advanced tools. And they frequently come and steal our laser cutter because it's a little bit more fancy than theirs. Smaller, but fancier. And then connected as well in the Invention Rooms, there's a community space. The community space is going to open September of this year, and that will be a real gateway. It'll have a cafe in it. It'll have rooms that users can access for classes and stuff. So.
And so if people are listening in and they're in that area...
please get in touch. If you're in the area,
hopefully they know about it anyway, but how would they go about getting in contact and
So the first step is in the makerspace itself, at least initially, I always don't want to get people's hopes up. So at the moment in the makerspace...
It's like the Hunger Games then?
Yeah.
It's just like...
Do you qualify?
If you're crawling in, you've done well.
So we do run community activities out of the makerspace that, like, where people can come in and use the tools and stuff. At least initially, I want to be honest, we're funded to deliver programs for 11 to 18 year olds, but we're looking to expand that. So we're building on people who are working with the community already and looking to try and get community groups in. So say you're an entrepreneur who has a great idea and you're in the White City area. Our aim is that you'll be able to come in and use our resources, prototype, then who knows, go onto the Hackspace. They'll help you develop an idea, start a business. You could be the next Bill Gates, and we want to make that happen.
That's very cool. So broader question. So what does maker or making mean to you?
Oh my gosh. It is my love, my life. I love it, I love it. So making to me is, I feel really strongly, and it's a line I use a lot, I don't believe in snobbiness when it comes to making.
I saw that in your article.
I feel so strongly about it. I don't think it has to have technology in it. It doesn't have to have a 3D printer. Making is everything from knitting to the newer technologies like laser cutting and 3D printing and new ways of prototyping. And the new making movement is what fuses all of that together, because that's the dream, where you have someone going, oh, well, I want a business that screen prints T-shirts, but actually I'm going to prototype that using the laser cutter, or I'm going to try and advertise that using whatever it might be.
So part of that almost sounds like an evolution of the sort of arts and crafts scene as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my background is, like, to make it very personal, one of my challenges has always been having to choose, and I hate that people have to choose. You're either into art and craft or you're sciencey,
and
it's such a stupid division. And like, my original degree was in maths and English literature, and that just goes to show you I've never been someone who likes to choose.
Well, they keep Imperial have this amazing, I don't know, the two people I've met that I well, not that I remember but of recent memory, shall I say, so Jess Wade and yourself both have that very passionate sort of cross-curricular, and you know, have studied different things and come to your sort of current pathway, as it were, but you know, not the kind of traditional, very linear route.
Yeah, and I think, especially with our collaborations with the Hackspace, I'm trying to build that around us, and I weed it out. So when people come and use the space, like, one of the magical things that happens via the outreach is when we run programs, we use undergraduate mentors who facilitate the sessions, and they're much closer in age to our students. They give them really great advice, but sometimes they can be quite linear in their thinking. So I'll overhear them saying, oh, is that all your design is going to do? And I'm like, no, I don't care.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
If that child wants to build or make a T-shirt and that's all they want to do, that is fine. That is as legitimate. And I think the great entrepreneurial opportunities come from that interdisciplinarity and sharing resources. And
need
skills.
More engineers knitting as well as...
Engineers knitting. I mean, our community team, I work really closely with Priya Palin for the community team. And they're doing really interesting stuff with research in terms of his... I'm going to get his name wrong now on a podcast. I'm sure he's called Professor Knitbone or Kneebone. But basically, he teaches suturing and surgery. And he got in people who actually know how to sew and weave. And he was showing
his
students...
It's a very fine skill,
exactly,
isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. And we can only get better by sharing those skills.
That's very interesting. So let me go to my book. I have my book here.
I'm sorry.
I feel like you're going to give good answers to this. That's why.
Oh, do? Okay.
Yeah.
So
choose a number between 1 and 100.
72.
Oh,
my brain always goes, why did I choose 72?
Right. Here we go.
I'm excited about your book. I feel this is very making too.
This was an impulse purchase from the Tate in St. Ives.
Oh,
and I just saw it.
It looks like kind of life.
Yeah, I think it probably is something like that. So would you rather be 3 inches taller or 3 inches shorter?
Well, I'm slightly above average height-wise and I love it. So 3 inches taller, please.
Okay, more of that, yeah.
I'm trying to think, why would I like to be taller as well? I mean, I think practically speaking, in a making sense, you reach more tools.
Yes.
Every so often, I don't advantage. Like, I'm a feminist, and I do not like asking for help, so.
Can you open that cupboard, please? I don't like asking for jam jars to be opened. Yeah.
Oh, well, one of the tasks we do in the make space that I love is something called mystery objects. It's from a previous job I had once, so it's a great idea. And you give random objects, designed objects that are kind of stupid to students, and you say, well, what does it do? And they look at it and they go, I don't know, idea. And one of them is actually like a rubberized disc.
Okay.
To open jars.
Nice.
And they it's stare like at that for a long time.
It's like the banana shield, which is a bit more obvious, but yeah. equally stupid in my opinion.
There's loads of stupid orange peelers, spider catcher always gets them. There's a kind of a cutlery drainer that they look at for ages. And then you tell them, they go, oh yeah, of course.
It's like the thing at the, have you been in the sort of museum part of the Wellcome Trust, you know, where there's all these weird and wonderful, quite scary implements.
But I love saying to them, look, it doesn't matter what you're going to invent, someone did that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And do you know what more? They not only invented it, they sold it.
That's a very good point, yeah. And it's always in those supplements that fall out of like the, you know, lesser tabloids, Daily Mail, that kind of thing. Okay, to leave, what tips do you give educators or parents that come along that want to help build this kind of creativity and inspiration in students?
Oh, you've asked me the golden question. I feel so strongly about this.
But I feel you must have been asked that a million times.
I have. And in a previous life, I used to train teachers to teach science, actually. And two tips, really. My two big, big things is, number one, you don't need resources. So makerspace can be... A roll of masking tape, some paper, and some markers. And you have a makerspace. Some Lego, of course. Like, where are we? You don't need much. So don't focus on fancy, fancy kit. Well, I suppose three things. I've just remembered another one. So don't focus on fancy kit. Anything can count as a makerspace. Just make flexible resources available and don't be precious about them. Number two, you absolutely don't need to know anything. I think the biggest mistake teachers or parents make is that they think they need to know it before they do it. And what they don't understand is it's fine to turn around to someone, I don't know. Like, how would we make a flying machine? I don't know. But the process of being honest and discovering that with the student is that's the magic moment. So don't think just because you're not sciencey that you can't facilitate or lead a session.
That's really interesting you say that, because as my son gets older, I think, you know, I'm going to have to like binge do revision around all these subjects as he sort of then goes in and, you know, comes home with all the questions, whereas actually that's part of the fun as well, that you're learning again.
And be honest, be like, wow, you're learning something I don't know.
Yeah.
You find out and explain to me. I mean, one of my favorite scientists of all time, Richard Feynman, always said that, you know, if you really understand something, you should be able to explain it to a two-year-old. And I think you can flip that. So particularly as students get older, I have students coming in saying things like, wow, I have no idea what you're talking about, but explain it to me. Let me find you someone who might know. It doesn't need to be you. It's facilitating and encouraging. I think sometimes people out of fear shut things down. Oh, we can't do that because I don't know it.
Or it won't work. Or,
yeah. Like, we at all costs avoid don't. It's a really, you can't do that. We tend to say, well, how can we make that happen? Or how can we help you make that happen?
And so did we get to number three?
Three, and I've totally forgotten it as I was speaking. I was like, I hope she forgets that I said three. Another great hero of mine, a guy called Randy Pausch, he was a lecturer, and he gave something called The Last Lecture. If you haven't seen it, look it up, it's amazing. But he said that his parents, the best gift they gave him was gave him white walls in his bedroom and said, write all over them. And so you don't need much, you need to encourage creativity and empower students. Be brave, be curious, I say.
Can you tell me a little bit as well about Imperial's role in the Christmas lectures?
Oh, no,
I was looking at
that's
that,
me. I
was looking at the Tetris thing.
Me, yeah.
Okay,
I did
please
that.
Tell
that
me about
that.
That
was one of my life achievements.
It was amazing. And I read that it was 6 months in the making or something.
6 months? Did they say that?
Maybe in a previous life,
I've done many weird things. And I tend to like saying yes to stuff because I think that's a really good philosophy. Say yes and figure it out afterwards. And so I was really lucky to be involved in the 2014 Christmas lectures, and the big project that I oversaw was turning, I think it doesn't even exist anymore, the building right beside the London Eye, it was managed by Shell, into a Tetris board. But the problem was we couldn't cheat, so we couldn't do projection mapping, we couldn't use any fancy technologies. It had to be essentially something that a student could do scaled up. So we put a lamp in, we put a lamp, right, like a desk lamp, in every single window. There was 184 of them across 13 floors. Then we had to figure out, okay, we have a lamp. Brilliant. Then we got Philips Hue light bulbs that you can program and change color. So each of those got screwed in as well. And then we were like, okay, we have that. It turns out that there's something called diffusion. So you can put a lamp in a window, but from the other side of the river, you're not going to see anything. So we then had to put greaseproof paper on every single window, and then Mylar behind that. And then all of that sounds, you know, challenging enough, but on the actual day, so we tested it on, and this is the bit that breaks my heart, we tested on a Sunday, and we were spelling letters. If anyone had been around, we spelled out R-I. I did a like picture, and it was all beautiful. What we didn't count for is on the day, number one, there was rain, which bizarrely affected the network. So we were live streaming from the cameras there straight back into the studio.
That is ballsy.
You just wouldn't think of yes, it was. So, yeah, it really was. So the rain affected it hilariously. And also we were doing it on a weekday. So everyone, it turns out, all those office people, as soon as they leave work, ring people. So the network was crowded. So we ended up using the cloud to like live stream back, and loads of the pixels, if you will, so the windows stopped responding. So I physically had to run into the building and go, I'm on floor 12, is it? And we could only tell by looking at them, there was no feedback. So we're like, it's the third window from the right. So it was like running right, because it was better to be a black pixel than the wrong color. We got it working. But yeah, it was one of those things in life. I'm very proud that happened, but it really broke me.
Yeah.
Well, and we had amazing volunteers. I have to say, we had volunteers every floor, and they were the ones who were installing it, because we had a very short window of opportunity. They installed it. But then a company that I may have mentioned earlier but will remain nameless have very strict safety protocols. So when the lights are off, no one's allowed to move. So the volunteers got trapped on each floor for like an hour and a half, and we couldn't talk to them, and they were stuck there. So thank you, volunteers. You know what made it happen. But yeah,
wowee. So literally they got, you know,
stranded. Yeah. And yeah, a great life achievement though, because that's a proper hack. Basically it was something that, so we had a Zigbee network, I wasn't explaining very well, so each, we had a bridge at the end of each floor that spoke remotely to a controller, and it is something that a kid could do, like a student could have done that.
And they could do that in their own house.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You could do it in your house, you could do it in your school. It's very feasible. Very feasible. Very feasible. There's lots of fun things, like everything. Our goal with that is
that
everything
we did. Did you go and celebrate afterwards?
You know what? I cried.
Did you? Like with joy?
I think exhaustion. And yeah. I came to a certain floor and my partner was there and I just went, oh, I kind of collapsed. Then I put my game face back on and it was lecture one of three.
Oh, my days. And then what's your big ambition? So if you could do anything with the makerspace you're currently in.
God. Well, do you know what? My genuine ambition for the makerspace is, I think, I went to a conference recently and someone described what makerspaces are and I thought, that's exactly what they are. So you should think of makerspaces like gyms. If you go to a gym, you don't need to be an Olympic athlete to go there, right? You don't need to be training for something amazing. If you just randomly go once a month and run for a bit, or like lift a bit of weights, then it's useful. And it's a useful place for people to go. And I think, yeah, I want makerspaces to be more useful than libraries and more useful than gyms. I want every community to have one. I want people to see that they're useful for intelligence, creativity, entrepreneurship, mindfulness, mental health, community, sociability, everything. I want it to become so, oh, we can never get rid of the makerspace. And that's my goal.
And what's your Twitter handle? I'm gonna just go
I'm so bad with
so
Twitter.
Shallow after that amazing statement. Just bring it right back
yes,
down.
Hit me. You want a makerspace? I'm gonna make it happen. Big ambitions. My Twitter handle is Mulcahk. So M-U-L-C-A-H-K-K.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Kate.
No problem.
It was great to meet you. So I'm here with Mia from Maker Club. We are here at the Lego Education Maker event in the evening, and we're in the heart of Lambeth. Yeah, everyone's making their own little canapes and doing maker cocktails and all sorts. And so, Mia, you're from Maker Club.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what Maker Club is and what your particular role there is as well?
Yeah, so at Maker Club we run out of school and holiday workshops for kids to teach them all about making and inventing, and basically to encourage them to create things. And I am the head of education, so I'm in charge of making all of the content and thinking up projects for them to do in the clubs.
And how did you come to be involved in that?
So I actually trained as a primary school teacher. And about halfway through my degree, I just got really into computing. It was around when the new computing curriculum was coming in. And I just really wanted to find out more and really like immerse myself in it. So I started volunteering for Maker Club. I think it was my second year. And from then on, I was just kind of trying to get my foot in the door. And yeah, by the end, luckily there was a job available.
They couldn't keep you out any longer.
Yeah, exactly. I pushed so hard that couldn't get rid of me.
It's very cool. So it's nice to think of it as like your dream job, though, and you know, if you're really passionate about being there. So what do you think Maker means?
It can mean all sorts of things, and my opinion of that has definitely changed over the years, but now I'm definitely of the opinion that, you know, anyone can be a maker, anyone who creates. So it could be food, like we've been making our canapés here this evening. It could be creating kind of art or digital media, or it could be engineering, you know, covers arts, science, all kinds of things.
You must see huge amounts of different groups come through and kind of tinker around. So what are some of the hesitations that you see among children, or whether it's adult learners or children, when they're kind of approaching this, and perhaps if it's the first time they've been in that kind of environment as well, or kind of charged with being as creative as they can be?
There is definitely a reluctance to just make or just create something, especially among adults, more so than children. Children have vast imaginations, but there are still some, they come in and you tell them to create something, they're like, I don't know what to make. Yeah.
Do you have any tips for educators or parents at home on how to sort of get over that initial hesitation and to make the most of the learning opportunity as well?
Yeah, I think just making sure that you provide an environment where creating things just happens all the time, and it's really important for failure to be a part of that. I think a lot of children are reluctant to create things because they don't want to get it wrong. So they will ask you like, oh, is it okay if I do this? Is it okay if I do that? And I think it's just really important to be like, yeah, you can do anything. Just play, experiment. If it goes wrong, that's fine.
And so Maker Club at the moment, how many clubs do you have, or what's the kind of structure? How does it run?
So we have 4 clubs now. Basically, they come along once a week after school. They come in and they access our online platform where they can either do a project that we've kind of given them, so it could be something where they follow step-by-step instructions that I've set for them, or it can be something more open and creative. What we generally say is when they first start, they will come and learn kind of different parts of being a maker or being an inventor discreetly, and then they learn to bring them all together, and eventually they'll get to a point where they can identify problems in the world around them that are meaningful to them and then start to solve them in an independent way.
And where are your 4 clubs?
We have got one in Brighton, one in Bournemouth, and 2 in London now.
And who's your big maker hero? Do you have like anyone that you think, yeah, they're really creative, and don't have to be specifically within the maker community, but it sort of inspires you in that kind of imaginative way?
I think my hero is probably Mitch Resnick. He, you know, talks a lot about constructionism, has worked with Seymour Papert, and developed Scratch, which is the first thing that got me into computing and got me into this industry. So
awesome. And are you on Twitter?
I am.
You are. What's your handle?
It's at itsmearstweets.
Okay, itsmearstweets. Perfect.
It.
Well, thank you very much, Mia. You survived your first EdTech podcast.
Thank you. It's been great to be on.
So I've managed to save Ethan Danahy from the sort of final pack up of the Lego event. So for that, you will be forever grateful, I'm sure.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
And Ethan, so I've got your job title here as Research Assistant Professor at Tufts University for the Center for Engineering Education and Outreach.
Yeah, Tufts University. I'm a Research Assistant Professor, basically doing research into educational technologies.
Okay.
That's sort of the bulk of what my research is. I operate within a group called the Center for Engineering Education and Outreach. It's a research group that's a real mix of different people. We have engineers, we have education, we have a variety of different people coming at the space of how do we change education? How do we rethink sort of what we're doing? The last 100 years of education has been pretty static. How do we start to really revolutionize that, push on it in different directions? For me, I think about it from a sort of technology point of view, right? I'm interested in sort of what are the tools and technologies that we can put into the classroom, the hardware, software, or even thinking about the entire environment. How do we change that standard classroom environment of kids sitting in rows, facing forward, listening to the teacher in the front? How do we shift that to then making the students, the learners themselves, in charge of their own learning? And what are the tools that we put into their hands to enable that shift to happen?
So that's really interesting that that's your main kind of research question, because that's pretty much like the question that, you know, the podcast seeks to ask in every episode. What's your kind of take on it? What do you think will really change education?
So, you know, there's this idea that we're going to find this silver bullet, that we're going to make the awesomest iPad app that suddenly is going to transform things. And that's a little bit of a chasing the wrong direction. It's a fallacy, I think. In that, what I don't like about the magic iPad app philosophy is that the student becomes very passive. They're mm-hmm. just doing what the app is sort of instructing them to do or enabling them to do. Yes, it's quote-unquote interactive, but they're not really minds-on, hands-on, fully engaged in that. And so I think there's also an aspect of it that we shouldn't be trying to make education easy. Part of being good education is that it's hard, that it's difficult, that mm-hmm. students are struggling with a concept, and then when they come to the end of that, when they come to a realization, that concept is going to stick with them a lot longer. So actually, I'm looking at how we don't try to pave the road and make it super smooth, but that we engage and enable students through that journey. And teachers are a huge part of that. The tools and technologies that we put in their hands are a huge part of that. Also, student buy-in, right? So they have to come to the classroom and say, I'm here ready to learn and relearn and learn, and it's a lifelong learning process.
On the podcast, you know, we have people constantly referring back to some of the more famous pedagogies of, you know, say the 60s. I rarely sort of hear of really well-established new pedagogical thinking. And I don't know. Is that something that you
yeah,
have an opinion
I mean,
on?
It's and it's a mix, right? So I don't, you're exactly right. And we certainly hearken back to a lot of those things. Mm-hmm. And there's bits and pieces that I think always need to sort of be there. But our attitude and our perspective is this idea, we call it kids can. So I also don't like this sort of attitude that kids can't do this, so we need to give them that in order for them to succeed. There's a lot of talk about what kids can't do, and at the center, at Tufts University, we take this philosophy that kids can. They're coming to the table with a wealth of prior experiences, information, understanding about the world around them. That understanding might be flawed, it might be wrong, but let's tap into that and leverage that, and then use that to drive where we then take them along an educational journey. I think the other aspect of it is really thinking about engagement, not just from a fun, so a lot of people think of it as like, oh, we'll do gamification, and then suddenly the kids will be engaged and they'll learn, but rather engaging them where they are at. So thinking about the context of their lives, community-based problems that they experience every day, how can we bring that into the classroom and use that to drive their learning? How do we think about clients? You know, we have our students design for their pets, design for their home, design for their grandparents. And suddenly, that's a really real problem that they understand, that they experience every day, and they would like to solve, just like in their fourth grade classroom or wherever it might be, just like we would then like to see them go off and be productive members of society, taking on those grand challenges that face society and trying to solve those in the future.
And here, so obviously we're here at this Maker event. So what's your opinion on Maker and the Maker movement and then how that fits into what you just spoke about as well?
So the Maker movement is an awesome experience in sort of community-based making, right? So we see in the informal spaces that people are passionate about their projects. They're leveraging expertise within a specific discipline. They're collaborating and communicating with others that are found within these community spaces around making. Education looks at that and says, oh my God, these are all things that we want. We want our students to be passionate, to leverage expertise, to talk and communicate with each other. Unfortunately, it's not a one-to-one. You can't just take the model that works in the community and put it into the school system and expect the exact same types of results. So the school system, our school systems, have these other constraints that they operate under. A class size of 30. Everyone has to be on the same schedule. The class is only 45 minutes. These things are actually in conflict with the sort of traditional view of making, which is take all the time that you need, follow your passions. It doesn't matter where you end up, as long as it's meaningful to you. That's very different than by 4:45 we have to understand slope in this math class.
The teacher's going to have a nervous breakdown. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So it's a mind shift of both the students and the teachers and the whole school community. That said, there is great potential within this idea of making, within the students doing hands-on projects that they are passionate about. And so what we're looking at is then how do we match those two things in a way that works within K-12 education or in primary, secondary school, or even at university as well, and thinking about what that model looks like. With the maker movement and maker spaces in education, people come to us all the time and they say, what 3D printer should I buy? And my answer is, that's the wrong question. You're not asking the right questions yet. Instead, who is your community? What are your learning goals? What skills are you pre-coming in? What types of objectives do you have with doing making within your education? Until you understand those, you can't even start to purchase equipment or design the space. So we do a lot of work around just understanding who the community of learners are and what their objectives are in order to then help with the design, eventual implementation, and then what we call the sustaining of that maker community within a formal education environment.
So that it doesn't just become a flash in the pan and, you know, it's a great sort of trend and then it's sort of the next year. No one's kind of kept it going.
And education is full of that, right? We have tons of those flash in the pans. And even the maker movement, right now, it's a flash in the pan title, right? So it's the hot new concept, but ultimately it's open-ended project-based learning. That's not new. We've been doing that for a very, very long time. And here today, we're at this event put on by LEGO Education to talk about the launch of their new maker activities. Again, the launch of hands-on project-based learning activities, that's something that LEGO Education has been doing for years and years. And so what they're doing is pairing their age-old philosophy of giving students power through the tools that they have, pairing it with these maker philosophies, pairing it with an engineering design process that helps structure it within the context of a classroom, and generating a community of learners where students are all inventing and creating something unique and individualized, but drawing the connections between the different projects that students are doing so that they're still learning from each other within that space, which I think is a really important, strong philosophy.
So part of your role here, so the outreach part, do you work with local schools? And
so it's really important, we believe, not just to do the research and development, but also to make sure it has an impact, that we want to actually influence classrooms. At a university space, you can often be talking to other university researchers, and that's where the ideas sort of filter. How do we get that down to teachers? And so part of that outreach that we're looking at doing has to do with reaching teachers and trying to sort of transform that classroom. And we do it through a variety of different things. One, hands-on workshops. These can either be local to people who are near us, or we do a lot of traveling. Here I am in London, reaching out to teachers and having these types of conversations. Second is through online communities. So we've been doing a lot of work in that space. We run legoengineering.com, an online community in collaboration with LEGO, where we try to inspire teachers to take those LEGO products to the next level within their classrooms. The other thing that I've been doing recently is Dr. E's Challenges. So at drechallenges.com, I'm Dr. E, and I put up a monthly challenge every month where we have open-ended projects that students around the world can solve, teachers can bring into their classrooms, document and share that work, which I love because people in different cultures and communities and will solve different challenges in different ways. So if it's a robotic animal, somebody in Germany is going to do it different than somebody in China, different than somebody in Australia. Or if you're building a robo chef using some of the Lego Mindstorms robotics equipment, somebody who thinks about cooking in one country will see it differently as another one. And this provides an opportunity to document, share, and then have insight into how other kids around the world are solving problems.
And if people are listening in and they want to follow what you're up to, are you on Twitter as well?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Ethan Danahy, so it's at edanahy. That's one way that you can find me on Twitter. And then again, following some of our websites. Right now, LEGO Education has just launched the LEGO Education Teacher Award. So they're actually looking for teachers around the world to share the work that they're doing. And the winners of that will actually be coming to Tufts University in June 2018, where we're hosting a big LEGO Education Symposium as well as a Tufts STEM Ed Conference. And this is an opportunity for teachers around the world, both the winners of that or anyone who registers and comes, to tap into some of, like you said, the energy that's happening around ed tech, around progressive pedagogies, around hands-on learning. Learning all in the STEM space or STEAM or thinking about transforming that education.
So I'm here with Kate. So Kate, can you introduce your full name and what you do and how you came to be here as well?
Hiya, I'm Kate Cromart. I work in a preschool called Happy Hours in Berkshire. I was a Lego tester for the Steam Park. It was interesting to see yesterday when I saw the final set, because we were in the fairly early stages of the set being put together, and to see some of the new bits. There's some springy bricks that I'd not seen before, some that was still an idea that was actually taken on board and turned into a proper Lego brick. That was really interesting to see. So from what they've learned from us, watching the children over the months, learning how the pieces work, working out what they do, you know, how the bits click together, how the boats float, you know, the boats actually work as boats, and the children are fascinated by that. Using the gears and how clicking those together, and all the moving things. Now that they've worked out what each component does, they're now putting that into place with other things. So they're not necessarily using the original ideas. They're now putting their own imagination, their own spin onto it, and building far more creative things, things that go alongside what they may be playing with as well.
And with that, are you finding that, you know, is it about school readiness and all of that kind of stuff?
It's certainly helped. It's been noted back to us as a setting that their creativity and their exploration of those things is, you know, maybe above some of the others that are there already that maybe haven't had that experience so far. They're also moving that on into the smaller Lego bricks, because they've been used to the larger preschool bricks. And they're already able to use the smaller ones in the primary setting and building things and using those parts.
And what's your personal opinion on what Maker means?
I love what the Maker means. It's a concept, just as a teacher, having those ideas kind of spelt out a little bit to support with those lesson plannings, because it can get exhausting, you know, as a teacher, thinking up new ideas. Yeah. Something that's, you know, just it's a gift.
So I'm here, we're right at the end, we're at the closing scene of the Lego Maker event in Lambeth, and I'm here with Karen Walsh, who writes for Geek Mum but also has a very important other hat, which is
I teach at the University of Hartford and I teach first year writing.
That's very cool. And so, well, first question, very broad. What do you think Maker or making is? What does it mean to you?
It's interesting because the Maker movement to me is something that's generally outside of what I do, but also totally integrated in ways I didn't realize. So, for example, we do a lot of projects where you're making something new, you're coming up with the ideas. I teach the research paper class at University of Hartford, so I try to explain to my students, you know, it's really about learning something and making new information. And the Maker movement is really a lot of that same idea. You're making something new and being creative with your own ideas and exploring them.
Do you think a lot of this is it's kind of semantics in a way, in terms of some people would call something Maker, some people would call it something else, but essentially it's sort of sometimes the same thing, but it's just how different people communicate about something?
I do, to a certain extent. I think there's a lot more hands-on in the Maker movement because there's kids involved. And when you get up to the college age where I am, there's not as much hands-on. And I've tried to sort of incorporate that more as I go forward, but the kids are more resistant.
Yes, that's very
interesting. So if it's not, you know, buy the book ABC, they don't want to do it.
That's very interesting. A, because, you know, why does that happen? And then B, because my perception of the sort of maker movement is that certainly it's more established perhaps in the US.
So I think what is really interesting is it depends on the pockets of where you are. Our school is just trying to create maker spaces right now. So our librarian was really excited that I was coming out here and going to be looking at maker things. And we're a fairly well-off community, so I was surprised that we hadn't moved towards it more formally in the past. But I think what you see in a lot of higher-end communities in the U.S. is people want grades because grades get you to college and college gets you to a job, so it's that cycle. In the lower socioeconomic brackets, you don't even have the option for that because you're trying to, you know, get kids to pass and meet standards. And so I think seeing the maker movement take over and incorporate STEAM more and keep English and math and arts together as opposed to separating them is going to be really important, especially going forward.
Very, very true. Yeah, we had a podcast last year about the same time on STEAM and STEM, which I have to dig out. So I'm going to do a random few questions from my special book here. So pick a number from 1 to 100.
9.
I like that. They've all been very at the top end. So let's see, a 9. Do you enjoy, this is a good one, do you enjoy being the center of attention or flying under the radar?
I prefer to fly under the radar, despite the fact that most people wouldn't guess that from the green hair and bright makeup.
Yeah.
That's all a mask.
Okay, interesting. So I think there's something about flying under the radar where you can kind of see what's going on, but yeah, take your time in interpreting it.
I tend to be more of an observer, or if I'm feeling like socially anxious, then I become personable.
Okay, that's, oh, I love all that. Do you have any guilty pleasures?
Let's see. I still like Avril Lavigne.
Okay, that's desperately guilty.
I like going to bed really early.
Yeah, I've been dreaming about that this week. What are you looking forward to?
What am I looking forward to? I'm really looking forward to 2018. So far, it's been a pretty good year. I have a couple of books that I'm supposed to be working on this year. I write for Geek Mom. I'm really looking forward to my semester to start. So I think that's really what I'm looking forward to, just like living life.
You got to make the most of every day. It sounds like a cliche, but
it's totally true.
It's totally true.
If you don't go out to, you know, the local pub and meet the locals, then
yeah, exactly.
You're not doing it right.
And what about people here? Who have you met this evening in the whole maker community?
Well, let's see. I spent most of my time, unfortunately, doing this stuff for Geek Mom. So all I got to do is meet. I met John. John's hilarious.
Yes, he is. I think he sounds like one of the Beatles.
And Andy is pretty fabulous. He's a teacher whose students do Lego first, and they just made it through the regionals, and they're going to nationals. And honestly, just everybody, I know this is going to sound like I'm pandering, and I don't mean it that way, everybody at Lego is so down to earth.
It's true.
Compared to some other people that I've met at conferences and stuff. They're just like normal people. It's this huge company, and everybody's working at this huge, internationally known company, but they're all like really down to earth.
So tell me a little bit about Geek Mom.
Sure. Well, Geek Mom is a blog. They used to be a part of Wired, and then they split off.
Really?
And so we just got our numbers in, which were ridiculously huge that I didn't even realize, because we're syndicated across Apple News and stuff like that. So we usually have moms, mostly like in that 18 to 35, 40 range is pretty much our readership. We write about comics, we write about education, we write about parenting, we write about movies, we do think pieces and reviews.
That is really interesting, because here, I think, you know, we're always talking about, you know, how to involve the teacher, you know, in co-creating things like, you know, what we're seeing tonight. But what have you learned from sort of both your own experiences of writing for Geek Mum, where how do you get the parental community involved and get that kind of triangulation of parents, teachers, students?
I think it's difficult. We were talking about this the other night at dinner, where you have sort of at least in the United States, and I don't know if you have it here, this kind of hidden area of PTO, where it's like the parents who are in charge of the fundraising and stuff like that, and you have to dial into
them. Don't mess with those mums.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
You have to dial into that in order to get the objects needed and the funds needed to buy things in our schools that are not part of the generally established curriculum. I think we have a Geek Mom Talk Facebook group where we've got some really great moms too. We come in, we hang out, and we just chat about our days and our lives. I think when you create those communities, it's important. I think teachers and parents need to work together. Your kid is not always the perfect one in class. Sometimes your kid is the person who needs some other child in the privates, raises my hand. And you have to own that. And I think when you can own that as a parent, you are more able to talk to your teachers about what your child's needs and what the school's needs really are and come together as a community instead of fighting against each other like, you're not giving Billy an A. He needs an A. And, you know.
It's not a transactional thing.
Right, it's not. And I see college kids who come in and they don't understand that, yes, there is this thing called work, and yes, there are these things called deadlines because mom and dad fought with the schools and got them what they wanted. So I think, to answer your question, I guess I got there the long way, is that in order to really create a community of parents and teachers and administration, you really need to all own the fact that nobody is perfect. Everybody makes mistakes. No kid is perfect. No teacher is perfect. And that if you can own that and come together for the betterment of the children, as opposed to wanting something for your child and make your child earn something and have that mutual respect for the betterment of a child, not for giving something to a child. That's really what I think I want to say.
And that's a gift to them in the longer term.
Right.
Yeah.
And sorry, that took a lot longer than I intended.
Not at all. And how about if people want to find out more about what you're doing and your work? I'm guessing you're probably quite prolific on Twitter and involved in all of that.
I'm on Twitter, at kayvonhard. At kayvonhard, not .com. At kayvonhard. I'm on Facebook, at Geeky Karen, I think. I don't even know. And you can find me on LinkedIn.
It's a bit like your mobile number, isn't it? Once you start to think about it, you're like, I have no idea.
I have no idea. I have a website, allegrosolutions.com, and I'll be filtering some more stuff on over to there. And really, just look for me on Geek Mom. That's my home away from home.
For this week, a huge thank you to all of the guests in this week's episode. Don't forget to check out the show notes at theedtechpodcast.com to find out more about their work and thoughts on makerspaces. If you'd like to hear more from LEGO Education, you can also subscribe to the EdTech Podcast on iTunes or Spotify and listen in to episode 96 on play-based learning. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and what you're up to in the world of making, so drop us a note at podcastedtech or at LEGO Education UK, or check out the EdTech Podcast Facebook or Instagram pages. You can also leave a voicemail for future inclusion at www.speakpipe.com/theedtechpodcast. We'd love to hear from you. Have a fantastic week and see you next time.